call is being recorded for quality control.
Oh, well, I got bad news for you. Okay, here we go. Hello, and welcome to That's So Ravenloft, a podcast. What is it? A podcast dedicated to 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, horror and dark fantasy gaming, and the dread domains of Ravenloft and beyond. My name is Megan. I am at Miss Megan J on Twitter. My pronouns are she, her. And this is my wonderful co-star, co-host. She's a star, but she's my co-host, who is getting a reprieve from having to do research for on a rare occasion in her life. Deanna. Hi, Deanna.
Hello, Megan. I am Deanna. I'm at Deanna Writes Inc. on Twitter, Instagram, and whatever else is going on these days. My pronouns are she, they, and yeah, you didn't make me work for this one. It was nice.
For today's episode, we are going to do a very thorough, you might even say exhaustive, deep dive into the recent OGL controversy. So, Deanna, why don't you start us off? Explain everything that's happened so far in the last 2 weeks.
This is not what we discussed.
What? Didn't you get the memo? Didn't you get the notes I sent you?
I don't like this bit.
I've been waiting for days to do this to you.
Oh, no. Bring back the shark jokes.
No, just kidding. We're the only Dungeons & Dragons affiliated thing on Earth that's not going to be talking about the OGL.
Nope.
Because it's over, and I didn't care all that much to begin with. But I'm glad it's... Well, you know what? I'm not even going to talk about it. Anyway, let's talk about vampires.
Yeah, let's talk about vampires.
We've been sort of skirting around the issue of vampires in D&D. We've talked about vampires in the real world. We've talked about vampires in pop culture. We talked about the game Vampire the Masquerade. With our lovely guest, Allie. And today we're going to get into the sort of nitty-gritty of vampires, vampire mechanics, and vampire monsters in D&D. You know, I did want to say one thing about this whole OGL thing. It really bothers me when people review things that they haven't read for, like, YouTube videos.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Be like, oh, this new book just came out. I'm going to do my review. Smash that like button. Hit that bell if you want to get updates. This is the new whatever campaign. Now, I haven't read this book and I haven't played in it, but here's the gist of it. I was like, this is not a review.
It was an op-ed at best.
Barely. It's just an op.
It's just an op.
So if you see somebody who starts a video or a podcast episode that's supposed to be a review and they say straight up that they haven't read it or they haven't played in it, you're probably not going to get a lot of great information.
Unlike us, we read everything we talk about here.
Yes. This is, I spent a long time with my head stuck in Ravenloft, so I feel qualified to speak about it, and I feel qualified to have you listen to me talk about it.
Yeah. And so I'll make asinine comments along the way.
So today we're going to be talking about vampires, sort of what they are in D&D, how they work, the different kinds of monsters that are vampiric in nature, as well as vampire and vampiric characters that exist within the world of Ravenloft and beyond, as I say. So the first thing that we're going to talk about is just the straight up bog standard old school vampire.
Just a guy.
It's just some guy who happens to be a vampire. He doesn't have a name. He doesn't have a backstory. He's just a vampire.
And we call him Steve.
Steve the vampire. So vampires are undead. As we know, they are categorized as undead. They are of lawful evil alignment. So they are evil, obviously, but they have this sort of... There's sort of a structure to the way that they exist and the way that they operate. They have sort of their own kind of code. They are CR 13, challenge rating 13 monsters, for whatever that means, which is basically nothing. When I'm designing an encounter, I honestly look at the proficiency bonus more than I look at the challenge rating, because I find that the proficiency bonus is a much better indicator of how hard they actually hit.
Yeah. I have a vague understanding of what challenge rating means, but if I ever have to do something where I need, like, look at a monster, I'm just looking at, like, its stats. Challenge rating, I'm gonna be honest, has too much math for me to care.
I don't think the math even works, even if you knew how to do it. And I don't know how to do it either. But it's, I think it, there's sort of a calculation between, like, how many hit points they have, how many attacks they have, spells that they have. Somehow that all gets tabulated together and that becomes the challenge rating. But I found that it seems to not matter how high the challenge rating is if you put a party of at least 5 level 5 adventurers up against anything, they're going to beat it.
Like, provided they have enough creative thinking.
I don't care if it's like an ancient gold dragon. Like, it just can't tolerate standing there and getting wailed on by 5 different people in a row. But the vampire as it exists in D&D has a lot, and this is the 5th edition vampire. There's been vampires in all different editions, but the 5th edition vampire is kind of in line with a lot of the vampire, the sort of classic Dracula vampire lore. So they have the shape changer ability, so they can transform into a bat, and they can also transform into a cloud of mist.
Ooh, and they can also automatically pass any polymorph spell cast at them.
Is that true? Where do you see that?
Oh, that's just a shape changer ability. It's on the polymorph card. I know, because I've tried to polymorph shape changers before.
And it's, oh yeah, they've got the shape changer tag. I see what you're saying.
If you are a shape changer, you automatically pass any polymorph spell cast at you, because you could just do that anyway.
They have an ability called Misty Escape, where if they get dropped to 0 hit points, they automatically transform into mist and can, like, escape off to their coffin or their resting place. They have a regeneration ability. They get 20 points at the start of each of their turn if they aren't in sunlight or running water. They can climb on walls, just like Dracula. You haven't seen Bram Stoker's Dracula, but there's an awesome scene in Bram Stoker's Dracula where Dracula is, like, climbing head first down a wall like a spider. It's really creepy looking.
That sounds horrifying.
It is. And they are weak against running water. You know how then in the vampire lore, like, the vampires can't cross running water?
Yeah. How strict is that? Like, if I have a jug of water, or like my character has a water skin, and I just pour the water in front of them at a slight angle and it runs in front of them or over their feet, does that count? Or
what I want to know is, what if you're holding a jug of water and you go running at them and just run into them as hard as you can?
Yeah, this is my running water.
Are you like a battering? Are you a battering ram at that point,
Megan? What about a water elemental?
Oh, that's a good idea too. What if, like, a water elemental just, like, made a circle around a vampire? Well, there you go. You know, there's a summon water elemental spell. Maybe if you're fighting a vampire, you could summon one.
This is my running water.
So it's a little bit different for vampires in D&D. It doesn't have the they can't cross running water. It's just that running water is like acid to them. So I guess if you push a vampire in a river, it takes 20 acid damage every time it ends its turn in the water. They can't enter somebody's house without permission. They take 20 radiant damage if they start their turn in the sunlight. And if you pierce their heart with a weapon made of wood, the vampire is incapacitated in its resting place and you pierce their heart with a stake, the vampire is paralyzed until the stake is removed. So it doesn't kill them, but it does paralyze them. It also has a charm ability, like it can look into the victim's eyes and mesmerize them and charm them. They can summon bats. They can summon bats, rats, and wolves to come and do their bidding.
Some of those seem more helpful than others.
I guess it depends. I mean, if you're, like, in a small room, having a whole bunch of wolves around might just be more hassle than it's really worth.
Yeah, that's a good point. Also, I'm just thinking of, like, I don't know what I would do if I was covered in rats. I might just give up.
I don't know. I feel like that would be okay. Depends on the kind of rats. If they're, like, cute rats.
Like, rats don't bother me at all, but if, like, there's 20 of them and there's one of me, I'm like, you know what? You've won.
20 rats? You'd be scared off by 20 rats?
Oh, I wouldn't be afraid. I would just give up.
Okay.
I tell people, like, if there is a survival, if I'm ever in, like, an accident with you, do not rely on me. I will give up immediately and just wait to die.
You're like, I feel like there's some kind of animal that does that. Like, if it's in danger, it just, like, its defense mechanism is to just die.
Oh, I actually do know what animal that is. That's hognose snakes. They're great. They pretend to be dead when they're threatened, and they flip over on their back. But you can flip them over on their front again, and they'll just flip back over like, no, I'm dead. Leave me alone.
Vampires, they have sort of, like, they have a bite attack. They have unarmed strike attack because they have, like, claws instead of, you know, they don't just punch you. They have claws that they attack you with. And they also have regional effects and lair effects. So the idea is that a vampire isn't just sort of walking around some random place. He's got a castle or a manor somewhere that has a crypt, that has a coffin in a crypt. That's his lair and that's his resting place. And there's regional effects for his lair. So if there's a notable increase in the population of bats, rats, and wolves in the region. Plants within 50 feet of the lair wither and their stems and branches become twisted and thorny. Shadows cast within 500 feet of the lair seem abnormally gaunt and sometimes move as though alive. That happens in Dracula too. A creeping fog clings to the ground within 500 feet of the vampire's lair. The fog occasionally takes eerie forms, such as grasping claws and writhing serpents.
Yeah, that's just like morning in Florida.
So, I mean, the classic D&D vampire is very much inspired by the Dracula of, you know, old horror movies, Hammer horror movies. It sort of hits all those tropes, although the mechanics are defined in such a way that it's sort of translated to D&D mechanics, sort of explain how these things work in a mathematical, mechanical sense. So, yeah.
That's Steve,
the generic vampire who lives in a generic castle surrounded by generic rats, and he does generic vampire stuff. Vampires create, they create what are called vampire spawn. So if...
I don't like that word.
You don't like the word spawn?
Ugh.
So they travel the ocean floor looking for beds of eggs. And they release their sperm upon the eggs. And then the eggs spawn as little vampire tadpoles, which eventually swim to the surface and grow up to be full-grown vampires if they don't get eaten by seagulls. What? Why are you laughing?
The best thing I've ever heard in my life.
No, that's not true at all, Deanna.
You know, however, dear listener, if that's how you want to homebrew vampires, who are we to stop you?
So vampire spawn, no giggling, please. Mm-hmm. Vampire spawn are basically, if a vampire bites a person and the person dies, they come back to life as a vampire spawn. And they're kind of just like vampire light. They have sort of most of the same abilities and weaknesses of a true vampire. Except they don't have the shape change ability. They can't control wolves and bats and things.
Oh, so you could technically, like, polymorph a spawn because it's not a natural shape changer.
Yes.
I'm making every vampire spawn into a chinchilla. They're all chinchillas now.
And they don't have, they're sort of under the mind control of their vampire master. So these are like your Bride of Dracula type creatures. You know, Dracula, or the Dracula goes out, he sees a sexy dame, he bites her. Feeds off her, she comes back to life as a vampire, and she becomes his vampire bride. And they're sort of semi-independent, you know, they have their own consciousness and their own will, but ultimately they're always going to do what their vampire master wants them to do.
I guess no one's like stopped to think about the fantastic poly representation of Dracula and his many wives.
I'm sure somebody has.
Someone write that paper for me. I don't have time.
It's not often depicted as a loving and mutually respectful relationship.
Shocking. Most Dracula inspired vampires aren't kind and giving lovers.
No, but there's a description here under the vampire spawn description that says that if a true vampire feeds its own blood to its spawn, the master, or if it feeds its blood to the spawn then becomes a true full-blooded independent vampire. So if for whatever reason the vampire master takes a particular liking to one of his spawn or her spawn, they can change that spawn into a full-fledged vampire.
I wonder what like the circumstances around that would be. Like, is it more, I want you to be your own person so this relationship isn't bogged down by this horrible power imbalance we have? Or is it like, well, I'm kind of tired of having you around, so here's your independence and now you can leave?
I don't know. I think it's more like, if for whatever reason the vampire spawn has like a charm or a personality that the master vampire likes, they kind of think that this vampire spawn would be more interesting if they had the mind of their own. I guess that's why they would do it. I don't think they would do it for altruistic reasons. I'd be like, you've earned your freedom with loyal service or something. Or maybe they just need another vampire around.
Maybe this is just how vampires get divorced.
Or maybe they want a protege. Like, if you're a vampire who wants a little mini vampire or a sidekick or a child of some sort, you make a spawn and then make it a full vampire, and then it can, you know, learn from you as an independent creature.
Oh yeah. So like, if you want to make a weird vampire dynasty, this would be how you'd go about it.
Yeah.
That's not creepy at all.
So what do you think happens if a vampire dies?
I know in a lot of pop media, when a vampire dies, its spawn or whatever it is in that particular adaptation either lose their vampirism or they die as well, or they're just aware that their quote-unquote sire is now no longer a part of existence.
But I mean, like, what if a full vampire dies?
They turn into dust? Dirt?
False.
False. Okay, I'm wrong. Shocking, I'm wrong.
They become something called a vampiric mist.
What?
Which is basically a blood-drinking cloud without any real, like, consciousness, like, conscious will. They just float around and drink blood.
You know, that's actually a more horrifying concept than just a vampire.
Yeah, it's we'll talk about it later, but it's used in a novel to explain there's one particular vampire who doesn't like being a vampire, and so he thinks about just like stepping out to the sunlight and offing himself. But the reason he doesn't do that is that he doesn't want to become a vampiric mist, because he thinks that's even worse. As long as he has a mind of his own, he has some control over who he attacks. But if he becomes a vampire mist, then he's just a mindless killer and will wreak all kinds of havoc. But this is some fine writing here in the description of Vampiric Mist. I want to read it to you.
Please do.
It says, indistinguishable from fog, aside from the charnel reek it exudes, a vampiric mist descends on a creature and causes the blood in the creature's body to ooze through its pores or spill out from its eyes, nose, and mouth. This blood wafts out from the victim like crimson smoke, which the mist then consumes. Doesn't that sound fun?
So that's horrifying.
Oh my god, you're not gonna believe the last sentence of this description.
If it's about sharks.
Like sharks in water, vampiric mists can scent blood from up to a mile away.
I hate that I was right.
So that's what waits for. I guess it doesn't happen under all circumstances, but If a vampire is destroyed under particular circumstances, they become a vampiric mist.
That's weird as hell. Who decided that? I want words with them. I just want to talk. Mainly, I want to ask why.
I don't know. I think they probably worked their way backwards. They were probably like, oh, what if we made a monster that's like a blood-sucking fog? That would be cool. Oh, where does a blood-sucking fog come from? I don't know. It's a vampire that like died, you know? I can kind of see that happening.
Yeah, but no. I left the house and it was really foggy outside. And now I'm just terrified.
This art is funny. It looks like a cloud that has like blood spaghetti in it. Kind of, it's giving me some Flying Spaghetti Monster vibes a little bit.
Vampiric mist.
Google got these like weird red veins going through it.
Oh, it does. It looks like a brain. Why would you do that? Who hurt you?
And let's move on to some other types of vampires. So those are kind of three just like generic vampires that you can kind of just put anywhere. Into your D&D game.
Slap him at the bottom of the ocean. We won't judge.
Okay, so in the adventure called Icewind Dale, Rime of the Frost Maiden, there is a gnoll vampire.
Oh, gnolls are the like hyena people, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tekalili is its name. It's named Tekalili. It was once just a regular gnoll. But it was like a regular gnoll who was the leader of a pack of gnolls. They became stranded somewhere on a glacier during the winter and there was no food. So Tekalili started eating the other gnolls. But the more he ate, like the more he continued to be hungry, no matter how much he ate. And then eventually after all the other gnolls had been eaten, Oral, the Frost Maiden, found him. And tossed him down into a tomb, and he's just basically stuck there in this tomb.
Sweet to eat people?
Yeah. And he's got some fun abilities. He's got a lot of the typical vampire stuff, but he also has something called Repulsed by Perfume.
Oh, yeah, I would imagine.
The vampire has disadvantage on melee attack rolls made by any creature wearing perfume or carrying an open container of it.
I imagine so. It's because they're canid based, so they have very strong noses.
I guess so. I cannot imagine any circumstance in which any of my players ever would make a point to suggest that they are wearing perfume, let alone carrying an open container of it. Like, oh, we're going to explore this icy cavern. You know, the barbarian gets out their axe and the spellcaster has their wand ready. And then the rogue opens up their container of perfume.
They just want to smell like rose hips.
Just holds it. And everybody's like, what the fuck are you doing, dude?
But, there's vampire gnolls in these caverns.
He's going to have the last laugh when they're all dead, yeah. And they have an ability called Frightful Cackle that can cause you to become frightened. I think that's fun.
Yeah, that's another hyena thing, because hyenas are terrifying creatures.
Mm-hmm. There's some good description of it here. There's some more nice writing here that I like about the vampire gnolls. It describes them as just like laughing as they're feeding on their enemies, which is nice and creepy.
Yeah, hyenas are terrifying. They'll eat you alive.
Well, then maybe they'll eat you alive. They wouldn't eat me alive.
No, they'll eat you alive, because remember, I'll give up.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Like, we can't eat this one alive. It's already dead. Look at it flopping around on its back. How do you know it's really dead? Roll her over onto her belly. Oh, no, she went over on her back again. She's definitely dead.
Yes, that is my entire plan.
And there's also Kobold from that same campaign, Rime of the Frost Maiden. There's also kobold vampire spawn that are Tekalili, the gnoll vampire, somehow encountered some kobolds and turned them into vampire spawn. So not only is there a gnoll vampire down in this cave, there's vampire kobolds down in this cave. Here's some fun description. The gnoll vampire, Tekalili, has a small number of kobold vampire spawn minions to keep it company in the caves of hunger. The vampiric kobolds are terrified of the gnoll vampire and can't understand its commands, so they give Tekalili a wide berth.
Oh, I love them.
It's just such a random detail. Like,
we don't know what you want.
He created these spawn to be his companions, but they can't understand him. It's like, I don't know. That's just kind of like...
That's so funny.
It's funny to me. Like, you, oh, I finally found a companion. I don't bother to teach them your language or anything, so you can't actually communicate with them.
Oh, I finally found a friend. Oh, you only speak Latin.
only speak kobold. So yeah, those are some vampires that are in the Rime of the Frost Maiden campaign. They're kind of insular. I mean, it's just there's the one Tekalili, and he's got some buddies. It's not like these creatures are spread out through all the world. But I guess it's possible that a gnoll can become a vampire and that a kobold can become a vampire too.
Yeah, it's good to know that being a vampire isn't racist. Anyone and anything can be a vampire if it so desires.
It's probably, I wonder if it's, I don't know if gnoll is a playable thing that you can play in D&D.
If it's not, they should change that. That would be great.
And then let's go to discuss, so there's two kinds of vampires that I found when I was doing my research. Vampires that exist within the Ravnica setting.
Ravnica.
Yeah, you know Magic the Gathering, right?
Yep.
You know Ravnica, right?
I do. That's the one with all of the guilds.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Orzhov player, because I play almost exclusively black and white.
Oh, cool. So yeah. That fits right in perfectly with what I'm about to say. There is a type of vampire in, like, a lot of the monsters in Ravnica are taken directly from magic cards. And there is a monster in the Ravnica book that's called Blood Drinker Vampire, which is, you know, pretty to the point.
Almost redundant.
and it's a vampire in the sense that it's an undead. And that it bites and drinks blood. But it doesn't really seem to have any of the other vampire abilities. It doesn't have any vampire weaknesses. But it also doesn't have, you know, spider climb or shape change or anything like that. It's just...
Also, it's a vampire, but lame.
It's a very straightforward vampire. But it says specifically that these blood drinker vampires are used as enforcers by the Orzhov Syndicate.
Yes! If anyone wants to have an impromptu, Orzhov is kind of like a church, and their whole thing is tithing, which means you can just steal life from other players. Like, yes, yeah. You've tithed to me. Oh, that's what the tithe drinker is, a card I played, and it's basically that, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So, one of the ways that you can give your tithe to the church is in the form of blood. So,
yep.
Blood drinker vampires come along and take your blood, and that's your tithe.
I'm really glad my very specific Magic the Gathering knowledge paid off.
It did. It did, in more ways than one. There's also within Ravnica a creature that's called a Mind Drinker Vampire.
That sounds blue. That's gotta be blue.
I was just gonna ask you, can you guess which guild a Mind Drinker Vampire belongs to?
Oh, what was the blue-red guild with the... Niv-Mizzet, the dragon
is that's the Izzet, but no, it's not Izzet.
It's not Izzet?
No.
Oh, it's give one up. Of the blue. It's
give
one
up.
Of the blue guilds.
You give
I
up.
Know it's blue.
You give up?
Yeah, I do.
It's House Dimir. It's the blue black.
Oh, it would be Dimir, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. So House Dimir in Ravnica is the blue black guild. They are like spies and. Spies and assassins, that sort of sneaky types. And they have a lot of like mind powers, and the mind drinker vampire can like drain your mental energy, I guess. So it can suck mental energy out of you and do psychic damage.
Oh, it's just my day job.
They can also have some psychic spells that they can use.
Oh, good for them.
Mm-hmm. And they're kind of like a higher up vampire within House Dimir. Well, not higher up, but like lieutenant vampires. Like they control lesser vampires.
Well, the guild system in Ravnica is weird because every guild sort of has its own internal hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing goes together and nothing makes sense and we all pretend it's fine. And there's the Golgari who just live in the sewers.
There's a, you know, while we're on the subject, this just reminded me, there is actually a Magic the Gathering character who's a vampire, Soren Markov.
Soren Markov. There's a couple. There's a whole set of vampire houses. I was actually talking with some people about them the other day.
Let's see. So there's Soren Markov. He's a vampire planeswalker from Innistrad.
If you don't know what a planeswalker is, it means there are many planes in the Magic the Gathering universe, but only planeswalkers can go between them of their own volition. Sometimes people just get sort of sent to different planes.
Yeah, and Soren Markov is one, but he's also a vampire. There was recently a Magic the Gathering set that was released called Crimson Vow. That was basically like two vampire houses within Innistrad were going to like merge with a wedding. And there was like a whole card set based around it.
Yeah, I do actually know what that is.
And I think it was...
It's Olivia Voldaren.
Olivia Voldaren and then Sir Edgar Markov, I think, is the one that she marries.
She's going to marry, I believe, Edgar Markov, which is Soren's dad.
Yeah, so the idea is the two clans of vampires are going to unite themselves into one by getting married. It's a really good set. It's really fun.
I love Olivia Voldaren because she's known very prominently for having some very unfortunate art of her.
I love unfortunate art. I'm going to have to Google it. My favorite genre of art.
The best way to find what I'm talking about is the Olivia Voldaren Lady Boner art.
Olivia Voldaren Lady Boner art.
Because you can tell originally the pose was she was supposed to be one knee up, one leg behind.
Oh, yeah. She's got it. She's got a raging boner.
But the final art has, you can see both her feet are down, but they left the angle where her leg would be, so it gives a very unfortunate silhouette, let's say.
Well, I know what I'm using as the, episode art.
You should.
You just download this sucker right here. Yeah, damn, girl. She's packing. Wow, that's all I'm going to be thinking about for the rest of the night. Okay. Anyway, so that's Ravnica. Let's look at some vampires from another setting. I'm going to tell you. So there's a vampire in the Spelljammer setting.
Oh, that's space, yeah?
Yeah, that is space. And I'm going to tell you what it's called, and I want you to tell me see if you can figure out what it is just based on the name. It is called a vampirate.
If this isn't a vampire pirate, I will be devastated.
Yay, you win the prize.
Oh, thank God. I love that term, by the way. I love the term vampirates.
So they are pirates who are turned into vampires or vampires who are turned into pirates. And they travel the astral sea on their spelljammers, attacking other spelljammers and drinking blood. They do drink blood, but they don't drink it with their mouths.
What does that mean?
It says, rather, a vampire drains life energy from another creature by touching it or siphoning off its energy from a short distance away.
Oh, okay.
Well, it says they can eat, drink, and sleep because they like to, not because they must. Well, that's fun.
What a nice life. You just eat and sleep because you want to, not because your flesh prison is like, well, if you don't do this, you're going to die.
Eat, drink, and draw vital fluids. That's all you need in life.
And give the suck.
And they explode into ash when you kill them, like the vampires in Buffy.
Oh, sweet.
So this the art they have of them is surprisingly jolly. These guys they look like a merry band, not like horrible scary monsters.
By the name vampirates, I feel like there's an inherent jolliness.
That's true. It's like you can't have a tongue-in-cheek name and then just be scary.
Oh, I love them. Oh, I just looked up their art. I love them immediately.
Yeah, they look like they're having a good time.
They're just having a good time.
So anyway, to do a slight tonal shift here, from the Jolly Vampires of Spelljammer. Let's talk about vampiric mind flayers.
Oh, good. Let's.
So a vampiric mind flayer is very much what it sounds like. It is a mind flayer that is turned into a vampire. So they have a lot of the classic they have some of the classic vampire stuff. They have spider climb and the sunlight sensitivity. They have claw attacks. Claw attacks, tentacle attacks. Kind of looks like the Demogorgon from Stranger Things.
I was just thinking that. It's got that weird tentacly mouth.
The Demogorgon, but the tentacles are a bit longer.
Just what we all wanted out of Stranger Things.
And they have an ability called Drink Sapience. So they can, when they like grapple onto you, they suck the brain juice out of you, and it gives you levels of exhaustion in addition to giving you psychic damage. The mind flayer vampires are, or the vampiric mind flayers are tied to the Ravenloft setting called Blutspur, which is sort of a mind flayer domain, which is ruled over by a giant elder brain, which is dying. So here's some more fun dialogue. Oh my god, this is great. I love this writing. I want to find out who wrote this. When the mind flayers of Blitzspur could find no cure for their overlord's affliction, their degenerating elder brain turned to radical methods to stave off dementia and death. The results were vampiric mind flayers, feral atrocities spawned from mind flayer tadpoles infected with vampirism. These specialized but flawed terrors serve a single purpose: to drain the cerebral fluids from sapient minds. After doing so, they return to the elder brain of Blitzspur, which liquefies them into its pool and releases their stolen essences amid a hormone brine. This grotesque balm stalls the elder brain's degeneration, but is far from a cure. I can't tell you how much I love the term hormone brine.
I can't tell you how much I hate that.
That is, I have never seen those two words together in my life, and I'm loving it.
That is, the writing is incredible because I'm so upset.
And then there's also another group of vampires that we touched on in another episode is the Zhangxi.
Ah, yes.
They're the sort of vampires inspired by Chinese lore. I think it's Chinese. There's a setting in Ravenloft that's called Ekath or Ikath. It's sort of like the not China Ravenloft setting.
In case you haven't noticed, we're very bad at pronouncing everything.
Yes. And they have some they have some interesting abilities. So they have some kind of classic vampire traits that the more classic D&D vampire actually doesn't have. So it says specifically they have a fear of their own reflection and they are susceptible to holy symbols. If they touch a holy symbol, they can be turned.
Back?
Turn undead.
Oh,
you're like, get out of here, undead. And then they turn around and run away. That kind of turn.
Oh, yeah. These are the vampires that don't get cool powers right when they turn. They get to earn. They have to earn their cool powers over time.
Earn it. Yeah. They can polymorph into different beasts. That's fun. They can consume energy and turn people into whites when they consume them. Their attack. I love this part. Their attack is the slam. Which is the D&D thing of saying it, they hit you hard.
Yes, I love it. Very true to the lore.
It says, when a soul becomes trapped within its corpse, its bitterness can reanimate its body, creating a Zhangxi. These vengeful dead stalk their descendants and the communities they knew in life, sowing terror and taking retribution for the slights or neglected burial rites that led to their cursed resurrection. So these are kind of like the classic East Prussian vampires in a way.
It is basically one-to-one for what I have in my notes for Zhangxi lore.
Yeah, your boy Arnold Paul when he came out of the... No, I'm thinking the guy that comes out of the grave.
Oh, the guy who just wants dinner.
Goes to his house and asks his son to make him food.
That's Peter Blagojevich is the one who's like, who rocked up to his own house and was like, give me dinner, son.
So I don't know if like maybe when they were writing this, they kind of took that Eastern European legend and applied it to this Chinese-inspired vampire, or maybe it's just a, you know, certain things sort of carry across cultures. Maybe that's one of those things. Maybe the traditional Chinese Zhangxi have that trope as well.
I mean, I also feel like...
Go ahead.
I feel like if I came back from the dead as a, let's just say, evil creature, I think the first thing I would do is just start taking revenge against people who slighted me. So I think it's just a part of the human condition. Like, I would be like, you know what? That person did cut in line at the Starbucks that one time. I will end their existence.
I just have this image of you in my head now. Like, you're so committed to finding this person who cut you in line at Starbucks that you go and get a job at Starbucks so that you can, like, wait for them to show up. And now I'm imagining you as a Zhangxi dressed in, like, a Starbucks uniform, standing behind the counter, like, with your arms stuck out in rigor mortis.
But I've got ups in both hands.
Spelling everybody's name wrong, waiting for this person that cut you in line to come in.
Oh, because I know how to spell your name. I'm just not going to spell it right. If anyone wants to make fan art of me as Zhangxi at the Starbucks, I would love that. It would make me so happy.
So that's kind of, I think that's it. I think that's the kind of, those are the most interesting, the most fun kind of vampires that I really wanted to hit on.
You want to hit on the vampires?
I want to hit on them with my slam attack.
Before or after the hormone brine?
After the hormone brine, forget about it. I'm like Olivia Voldaren. She looks like she's taking a good long soak
in the hormone brine.
So now I want to talk about some specific vampires who exist within the fiction of Dungeons and Dragons. Some specific named vampires. There's a lot of them. Some of them are just kind of, they have a name, but they're just kind of like an incidental character, and they're not that, like Tekalili, you know, has a name, but Tekalili is not like a integral part of the campaign. It's just something you encounter along the way.
Just interesting because it is a gnoll vampire. We don't get that very often.
Yeah, but in terms of vampires who are also characters, the big one is Strahd von Zarevich. And I'm looking at his stat block right now, and one of the things that people complain about with Curse of Strahd is that the final confrontation with Strahd is too easy, because he's, by the time you fight him, you're like level 10, and let's say you're a party of 4 or 5 players fighting a challenge rating 15 monster. He's only got 144 hit points.
All you gotta do is hit him.
Yeah, I mean, 4 level 10 characters are gonna mop the floor with this guy. And that's kind of one of the criticisms of Curse of Strahd, is that you get to this final battle that's been building for the whole campaign, and it's kind of anticlimactic because you just, you know, mop the floor with them. And there's some things that have been published on the DMs Guild and on the Curse of Strahd Reddit that are kind of like recommendations for how to sort of beef up Strahd for the final battle. He basically has the same stats as a regular vampire, except he's also a spellcaster. So he has up to 5th level spells. It's got some good ones. Animate Dead, Fireball, Greater Invisibility.
I feel like Fireball is a big risk for a vampire to take.
Well, they don't have any fire weakness, so.
That's fair.
He doesn't care.
Yes, he doesn't care. Also, I hope you're fighting him outside.
Mirror Image, that's one of my favorite spells. I always give my magic user characters Mirror Image.
Love Mirror Image. Think of how annoying I can be when there's 5 of me.
So how much do you know about the story of Strahd? I don't know how much detail we went over in our first episode. I can give you sort of the main beats.
Well, I did play in your, like, OG Strahd campaign.
That's right. Yeah.
So I know whatever we went over there, which is he's looking for a lady, a specific lady, because he consistently cannot get the lady.
Yeah, I mean, that's it in a nutshell. you hit the nail on the head with that one. But
it's a tortured romance, what can I say?
The idea is that, so once upon a time, Strahd was the son of the king, and he was a great general, and he led the king's armies to conquer a land that was called Barovia. And he liked Barovia so much that he decided to settle there after he conquered it and build his castle, which would come to be called Ravenloft. and he invited his younger brother, who is named Sergei, to come and live with him in his castle.
There's no Eastern European influences here at all.
No, certainly not. And Sergei was, so by this point, Strahd is like, I don't know, mid-40s. He spent his whole life on the battlefield. Meanwhile, his younger brother is like 20, 25, and he's young and full of life, and he's handsome, and everybody likes him. And Strahd is just kind of a tool that nobody likes. So there's some, you know, sibling rivalry there, but everything is okay until Sergei meets this peasant girl named Tatiana, who is beautiful and pure of spirit, and everybody loves her, and she's, you know, super nice. And Strahd becomes like, he says he's in love with her, but basically he's like obsessed with her and wants to possess her. He is approached by this being that approaches him has sort of different definitions depending on the adventure you're playing. But it is one of the dark powers of Ravenloft, one of these sort of godlike beings that rule over Ravenloft. This dark power approaches him and it's like, hey, I can give you your... So Strahd thinks that the reason Tatiana loves his brother and not him is that his brother is young and that he's old. Not the fact that his brother is nice and charming.
And he's
and handsome. And that he's a bitter old dick. So the dark powers tell Strahd, if you, we will give you eternal life. You won't grow any older. We'll give you the means to, have Tatiana for yourself. And he agrees and he is made into a vampire. He murders his brother on his brother's wedding night. And that kind of seals the deal. that act turns Strahd into a vampire.
He gets turned into a vampire by the ultimate cock block.
Oh, don't worry. His cock's going to get plenty blocked. So he goes to Tatiana. He's like, hey, good news. Your fiance is dead. Now we can hook up. And she's like, oh, no. And she jumps off the top of the castle. And he's so upset by this that he goes to the chapel where all the wedding guests are gathered, like, wondering what the hell is taking so long.
They've just been like... Oh, I wonder, wasn't it supposed to start at like 7?
Did you see a body fall by the window?
Isn't it weird that the groom's not here yet?
What's all that screaming? And then he just murders all the guests at the wedding party.
Sure, reasonable reaction to this.
And all these acts of evil combined draw this realm of Barovia into the demiplane of dread. The mists surround Barovia. And Strahd is trapped in there from that point on. And his curse is that, like, once every generation, Tatiana is reincarnated as somebody else. So Strahd is always kind of, like, waiting for the next Tatiana to come along. And every time that she does, she gets sort of spat back out by the Wheel of Fortune. He tries a new strategy to make her love him and become his wife. But
he hasn't yet stumbled upon just being nice.
No, Deanna.
Of course
he is,
not.
He is as toxically masculine as it gets. That thought never crossed his head. But every time he finds a new Tatiana, it always goes wrong and she always ends up dying. And it's always Strahd's fault in some way. So he always, every time it happens, he's like, well, next time I won't do that. I'll do this instead. But he's just like in this cycle. He's always going to fail every single time, no matter what he does.
Makes her a delicious lobster dinner only to learn that this Tatiana's allergic to shellfish.
She's like, I'm allergic to shellfish. And she throws herself off the tower. Yeah, no. So that's Strahd. He is a vampire who's obsessed with this one woman that will always reject him.
By dying.
What he does for all eternity. And he will never learn. That's one thing that I like to emphasize whenever I talk about the Dark Lords of Ravenloft. They cannot grow. They will not grow and change. You know, at no point will Strahd ever be like, you know what? Why don't I just, you know, try to marry somebody else? Maybe somebody else who's closer to my age or somebody else I have more in common with.
Of course not.
Somebody who likes old guys, you know?
Someone who's into silver foxes and also vampires.
But no, it's always got to be her. He's always like, what he wants to possess her, and he will never change. He will never realize the error of his ways. He will never sort of, he's incapable of, I say he's incapable of, he's incapable of self-reflection. He's incapable of any kind of reflection. Yeah, that's
all of the strong. All of the dreadlords have big I can fix him energy. No, mm-hmm. you can't fix him. Mm-hmm. That's the point.
Yeah.
And if there's a Strahd in your life, you can't fix him.
The way I see it is, if Strahd had been like a bad person, yet was capable of changing, the dark powers would not have noticed him. You know, it's the fact that he is going to keep doing this same thing over and over again is sort of what attracts them in the first place. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I like that. I like that thought. I mean, it's a sad thought. It's a bad thought, but I like it.
And Strahd actually has a niece. And anybody who is playing in my campaign, don't listen to this part because there's going to be spoilers.
Yeah, get out of here.
Skip ahead to this time code.
We'll edit that in later.
No, we won't.
We won't. I say we. You won't.
I'll say, okay. So Strahd has a niece named Lyssa von Zarevich.
Are you listening, Lyssa? We know you are.
She knows. I told her. As soon as I started that campaign, I was like, hey, guess what? I'm doing a campaign with a character named Lyssa in it. Oh my God. This is great. I never noticed this before.
It's a very dear friend over at Slovenly Trolls.
Yes. Slovenly Trolls podcast.
Go listen to them.
Click the link here to listen. So Lyssa von Zarevich, here's her description on Mystopedia, the Ravenloft Wiki. It says, Lyssa von Zarevich is the daughter of Anna von Zarevich and Todd von Zarevich. The granddaughter of Sturm von Zarevich, which makes her the grandniece of Strahd von Zarevich.
Wait, so Strahd had two siblings then, Sturm.
Sergey and Sturm, yeah. And
Sturm?
Sturm, like storm, but with a U.
Oh, okay.
Or sperm with a T.
Okay.
So she eventually becomes a vampire through some means. I don't remember exactly what it is, but she becomes a vampire and sort of travels to Barovia to meet up with Strahd. And her whole deal is that she wants to overthrow Strahd and take over Barovia for herself.
Yes.
And to do so, she makes some kind of alliance with the Elder Brain of Blitzbur, who we spoke about earlier. And
we love a crossover.
And she is responsible for creating the illithid vampires. So she bites the mind. She turns the mind flayers into vampires. And tries to use these vampire mind flayers to overthrow Strahd. It doesn't work.
Startling, this plan could ever fail.
Doesn't work, but according at least to the second edition lore, because this is all in second edition, she ends up remaining in Barovia as kind of like eternal enemies with Strahd. And that's something that kind of happens. That sort of happens to anybody who gets sort of too close to Strahd or anybody who gets in his orbit. They sort of get locked into this same curse with him. So, you know, Lyssa is sort of condemned to be his enemy for all time. And they're just going to battle against each other for all time. And nobody's ever going to get the upper hand. It's just going to go on and on. Strahd has some other enemies like that too. There's a lich named Azalin, who is Strahd's enemy. And they just kind of fight back and forth with nobody ever winning. So that's sort of a theme of Ravenloft.
You can't win.
The dark powers are essentially omnipotent. The dark powers are more powerful in Ravenloft than the gods are in the other worlds. They have basically absolute control and can really do whatever they want. And they have nobody countering them. You know, it's not like there's the dark powers and then there's the nice powers and they're like at war with each other. There's just the dark powers.
And they're just here to ruin your day.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of they're here to ruin Strahd's day, but Strahd's, you know, kind of deserves to have his day ruined. So I like to apply a slightly more ambiguous morality to the dark powers. You know, like they're evil, yes, but they're sort of a method to their evil.
You can't fix them, Megan. You can't fix them.
Yes, I can. another vampire that I wanted to speak about is a vampire that's named Jander Sunstar. Jander Sunstar first appears in a novel that is called Vampire of the Mists, It's the first of the Ravenloft novels. And he's an elf vampire from the Forgotten Realms. So he starts as an elf, obviously. And then he is like traveling with this group of adventurers, and they get stranded in this town that's under siege by vampires. And Jander and his party like are trying to defend the town against vampires, but ultimately his like companions sort of fall to the vampires one by one, until Jander is the only one left. And then he ends up like, he flees the town after everybody's dead, and then he encounters the vampire who turns him into a vampire. So Jander becomes a vampire spawn, essentially. And then his master gets killed somehow. I forget how his master gets killed, and that gives Jander his independence. And he,
you know, like when your boss dies and you get to be the boss.
Yeah, exactly. And so he kind of just lives in the outskirts. He's a vampire, but he's still kind of got that elven side to him. So he doesn't want to hurt people. So he kind of lives out in the outskirts of the town, or the outskirts of the city. Like, he lives in the woods. He's got his own little cave. He feeds on animals, but he can't only feed on animals. He has to sometimes go feed on humans. And so what he does is he goes to the asylum, the lunatic asylum.
That's in, good.
Waterdeep, I think. Maybe Waterdeep, maybe Neverwinter. But he goes there and...
Sorry, those names hit me really funny. Waterdeep.
Waterdeep.
Neverwinter.
Neverwinter. It's one of those two, I think. So he goes there, and basically what he does is he goes and finds one of the patients at the asylum and drinks like some of their blood. He doesn't drain them. He doesn't kill them. But he drinks some of their blood, and then they can't report it because they're crazy. Nobody believes them.
Oh, that's unethical at best.
Yes, it is. But on one of his trips, he finds that there's a new patient named Anna who is... who's locked up in the asylum, and she's like, full on nuts. She's as crazy as a loon. But for some reason, Jander falls in love with her. the only like conscious word she ever says to him is Barovia. And he doesn't know what that means. He's never heard of it. She ends up getting sick. She gets sick and dies. And
shocking, because I assume this asylum is very health conscious.
She gets sick.
They just let this vampire run amok.
And Jander in his grief is driven to madness, and he ends up like slaughtering all the patients at the asylum.
Buddy.
And that act of evil gets him sucked into Ravenloft, where he meets Strahd. Him and Strahd kind of have this like on again, off again homoerotic relationship. Not really, but that's how I like to interpret it. They're very much like Louis and Lestat from Interview with the Vampire.
This is where we'll put the link for Megan's fanfic.
So Jander and Strahd, they're kind of buddies for a while, because like neither of them has ever met another vampire before, really. So they're kind of friends for a while. Strahd starts like renovating Castle Ravenloft. But eventually it turns out that Anna, whom Jander fell in love with at the asylum, Anna is actually a reincarnated Tatiana.
Oh, damn it.
Yeah. And then they find out about this. Jander finds out what Strahd did to the original Tatiana, tries to kill him. He hires some adventurers to help sort of kill Strahd, but not permanently. And then then Jander steps out into the sunlight to kill himself, and it all sort of starts all over again. So he's very much the Louis. He's the Louis to Strahd's Lestat. You know, the sort of vampire with supposedly has a conscience, but also does evil stuff.
Yeah, the Dark Power is referring to his, like, grief-stricken rampage as evil. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that's evil. It's like, sorry, my brain is like, if this were a legal battle, yeah, you could probably argue... not guilty by reason of insanity or mental deficit, if you really want to.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what the novel is going for, that he didn't really intend to hurt these people. He just lost his mind.
Yeah.
But it's good enough to get him sucked into Ravenloft.
It's bad enough to make him buddies with Strahd.
So there's another vampire that exists within the domains of Ravenloft that I want to talk about, because they are one of my... one of my favorite vampire characters of all time.
Excitement.
I might refer to them as he accidentally, because for some reason I made them a he in my campaigns, although they're actually a she in the canonical campaign.
Non-binary icon, I love it.
But they're in the Ravenloft domain of Sithicus. There is the Dark Lord named Lord Soth, who is from the Dragonlance setting. And in his second edition adventure, some of the Kender from the Dragonlance setting somehow get stranded in Sithicus with Lord Soth. And the Kender are like, they're kind of like halflings, but they're very happy-go-lucky and they're immune to fear and they're super curious. And Soth doesn't like that. So he does some kind of experiment that turns all the Kender into vampires. So there are vampire Kenders in his domain who are, you know, they're still cheerful and curious and happy-go-lucky, but they also murder people and drink their blood.
That's arguably more terrifying than the alternative of just, like, really angry, sad Kender who just want to hurt you.
There is one in particular who is a character that features in the adventure named Tickle Mop Toothfang.
I've never loved a name more.
So that's the one. So Tickle Mop is female in the adventure. For some reason, I always think of her as male, and I don't know why that happened. I just somehow that got lost in translation.
I mean, to be fair, Tickle Mop is a very gender neutral name.
Yeah. So Tickle Mop Toothfang is somebody you meet during your adventures in Sithicus, and is. She is, I forget exactly what her motivation is because I changed it for my own campaign, but she is basically like trying to convince Soth to like take control of the domain again by giving him this medallion that she found. Yeah, I use her as an NPC because I'm running my own homebrew campaign that's set in Sithicus that's sort of inspired by that adventure. And my campaign, Tickle Mop, is a he. But Tickle Mop is basically like, follows the adventurers around, like trying to befriend them, but also occasionally trying to attack them.
Don't we all have a friend like that?
Well, Tickle Mop is like, he's friendly, but he has zero impulse control.
Every friend group has a Tickle Mop.
And I portrayed him as, instead of turning into a bat, he turns into a big mosquito.
Oh, you did mention that. I love that.
Yeah,
I love that so much.
So that's Tickle Mop. That's the Vampire Kender. And in the newest Dragonlance campaign, the one that just came out in December, there's another Vampire Kender. This one is female, named her name is Lori Wanwillow. And the characters meet her. She's been like trapped in this ruined city for a couple hundred years. She was turned into a vampire by this guy who was like, so there's a vampire who thought it would be interesting to try to turn a vampire into a Kender, or a Kender into a vampire.
I can see how they would think that was interesting, yeah.
And so he did it to Lori, but then he was like, he was stuck with her. She's just, and she was so annoying that he ends up like walling her off in his own section of the city.
Oh no, she got Cask of Amontillado'd.
Yeah, so when the players meet her, she's like just managed to bust out. And, like, it's not set up as a combat encounter. Like, she can be your friend, but she's evil.
She just wants someone to talk to.
So I have recently signed up for a campaign a short campaign that's actually going to be starting on Wednesday. And so I have created a character who is a Dampier. And a Dampier is a new kind of sub, they call it a Gothic lineage. It's kind of a different, it's not really a race. It's not really an ancestry. It's just like,
yeah,
you can play as somebody who was once a normal humanoid who becomes half a vampire.
Yes, you are whatever your original base race, ancestry, lineage is, and then you can slap Dampier on top of it.
Yeah, so this character that I've created, her name is Trixie Nightbloom.
Oh, I love that.
So she's a Kender. So in my version of it, so they have some different like suggestions for how they become a Dampier. No, you can roll on a table here. Let's roll on this table and see what happens. All right, we're going to determine your Dampier origin.
Mine? Yeah. Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, I rolled a 5. So tragedy interrupted your transformation into an immortal.
What is that? Like, I was mid-transformation and someone gave me a really sad phone call.
You're like, all you need to do to become a full-fledged immortal vampire is not take any phone calls for 20 minutes. And then you get a call being like, your puppy is in the hospital.
It's like, it's from my mom. I'm like, no, I gotta take this. She'll panic if I don't pick up the phone.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what that's supposed to mean, but you're in the process of becoming an immortal and something interrupts it. I'm going to roll for myself, see what I get. This is how I became a Dampier. I also got a 5. Let's try again. 7. One of your parents was a vampire. There you go.
Oh, so in this universe, vampires can, I guess, breed in a standard manner?
Yeah, in 5e Ravenloft, Jander has a daughter.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah, so there's...
Wait, with Anna?
I don't think so. I don't think it said specifically who it was. Just some broad he met.
Like, I hate when they do that. It's like, he has a daughter. With who? That is an important question.
That's a whole other half of the story you're leaving out. But my origin for Trixie is that she was like a burglar who snuck into a necromancer's castle or something looking for goodies. And she finds this, like, choker necklace, like a black silk choker necklace with like a red opal or something on it.
Very goth.
Cool. And she puts it on. And then the opal like attaches itself to her, and that turns her into a vampire.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Thanks. I thought it'd be fun to be like, to have an object turn somebody into a vampire rather than like, have you ever seen the movie Kronos by Guillermo del Toro?
When are you going to just stop asking me if I've seen movies?
I'm sorry. I lost my train of thought. Oh, so yeah, that movie Kronos with Guillermo del Toro directed is sort of about an object that turns people into vampires. So yeah, I just thought that would be neat. She just finds this thing that gets stuck to her and then she becomes a vampire or half vampire.
I guess this is my life now.
And then different vampires can have different kind of hungers. So let's roll on this menu to see what your vampire hunger is, okay?
Oh, please don't be the one that I hate.
What? Sharks? Like shark fins?
No, I know cerebral spinal fluid is on that table. I hate that so much.
Oh my god, I'm not even kidding.
Did I get... Oh, you did. I'm coming for your brains now.
So you need to feed on cerebral spinal fluid.
And it confuses me because the body does not have a lot of that. Like, yeah, make plenty of blood. But cerebral spinal fluid, there's not a lot of it, and it takes forever to replenish if it does. So it's the worst thing. I'm going to always be hungry.
You seem to know an awful lot about cerebral spinal fluid for somebody who supposedly never drank any.
Look, if you look at my Netflix watch history, it's just a bunch of really bad medical traumas. I just finished watching New Amsterdam.
Let's see what mine is.
We can't both drink cerebral spinal
fluid. Ooh, psychic energy.
Oh, that's cool.
So I'm like Colin Robinson from What We Do in the Shadows. I'm a psychic vampire. I just tell people boring-ass stories until they die. So yeah.
Is that why we started this podcast?
So dampiers are pretty fun. You get this cool little backstory. You got some special powers. You're a bit faster. Your movement speed is 35 feet. You can keep some of your ancestral legacy. So like if you're like a sea elf that becomes a vampire, you maintain your swimming speed. So that's fun. You get dark vision no matter what you were before. You don't need to breathe. You can spider climb at will, and you get a vampiric bite attack. So you can bite someone and deal 1d4 damage and regain a little bit of hit points from doing it.
Oh, I can't make them my thrall, can I? No. That would be cool.
No, you'd have to
probably
be
a little broken.
Be a full vampire to do that. But Dampier are fun. I had a player in one of my campaigns who is a Herengon Dampier.
I love that.
So she was a little she was a vampire rabbit, and I used to make Bunnicula references.
You would have to. That's so cute. I play a Herengon bard in a different campaign.
Oh my god! I'm so not surprised.
She, I gave her the adopted background, so she was raised by two dragonborn, and a la the one scene from Kung Fu Panda 2, someone had to tell her she was adopted.
Yeah. So that's Dampiers, and that kind of finishes up everything that I wanted to go over. I think that was the last thing I wanted to talk about. So that's kind of the big that's the vampire monsters and some of the vampire characters that exist within D&D. Vampires can be, I mean, they can fit in pretty much any setting. They can be usually evil, but you can have ones who are slightly less evil. You can have ones that are evil but friendly, like Tickle Mop.
Who are we to tell you how to make your vampire? Go with what your heart feels.
What do you mean, who are we? We're the people hosting this podcast. We're the authority.
Oh, that's true. We are the authority. You have to do it how we say. I forgot.
You have to do it how we say.
Yeah. You are allowed to make vampires spawn at the bottom of the sea. They're just contaminated eggs from the bottom of the sea. You are allowed to do that.
Yeah, that was fun. What do you want to do next?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. What do you want to do next?
I feel like maybe I want to do mummies next.
Ooh, I love that.
How do you feel about mummies?
I have never had strong opinions on mummies, but I'm definitely eager to learn.
Yeah, I just did a whole arc in my Ravenloft campaign where they went to Harakir, which is like the mummy or the ancient Egypt domain in Ravenloft. And so there's a lot of mummy stuff going on. There's not as much mummies in D&D as there is vampires, but there's still plenty of fun mummy stuff you can do. So
we'll be sure to.
It may not take us as many episodes to go over mummies, but
we'll be sure to dig up some information for you.
Oh my goodness, she's so funny. So I guess that's it. I guess we'll just wrap things up by saying thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks for talking to me, Deanna. Thanks for listening to me talk.
Always. And thank everyone for listening, and we will be back soon with mummy facts.
Yeah.
And maybe some daddy facts.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.